The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport pod on The Athletic. Coming up today, with the National Football League draft around the corner, an event with a huge TV audience, we'll discuss why the event continues to be such a reliable money spinner for the NFL and why it is such an important launchpad for the profiles of college players entering the professional ranks. This is the Business of Sport from The Athletic. So as regular listeners of the pod know, every week we seem to crowbar a reference to the NFL in comparison to what is going on in UK sport, particularly when it comes to football this side of the pond. Well, we don't need to crowbar it in this week. The whole pod is going to be based on the NFL draft, which kicks off on April the 29th, runs till May the 1st across locations in Cleveland. If you don't know, if you're one of our UK listeners, it is an iconic American sporting ritual where college players, previously unpaid, are selected by pro teams and paid lots of money to play on Sundays. That is the draft in a nutshell. And the reason we could do it like this week is Matt is away, so we don't cover UK football this week. It's all about the NFL. We do have an English voice with the Athletic's Ed Mallion, although you are in Chicago, aren't you?
I am, but still very much British.
But still very much British. And Robert Mays, host of the Athletic Football Show and one of our NFL writers, also Chicago-based. So I've been on your pod, which was a lovely experience. So I hope this is the same for you on this one.
I'm so happy to do it. I'm looking forward to it. The fact that Ed and I are about 4 or 5 miles away from each other right now is very funny.
And we are all Bears fans as well, but we won't let our despair affect the
misery.
Positivity of misery. Actually, forget despair, misery. Talk to me about the draft. Give me an outline of the significance of this event, both sporting and business.
In terms of this actual sport, you know, if you listen to any NFL executive, they will tell you we want to build through the draft. And the reason for that is it's the soundest way to add talent. The way that, especially after the new CBA was introduced in 2011, the rookie wage scale was put into place that controlled the salaries of rookies per their draft slot. Before that, some rookies at the top of the draft were some of the highest paid players at their position. You know, when Sam Bradford was drafted first overall in 2010, he was paid like a successful rookie quarterback before he'd even played. But after the rookie wage scale was put into place, those salaries were muted and pushed down. So now if you can assemble a lot of rookie wage talent, you can build a fantastic team while being able to spend in free agency. So hitting on the draft, especially at quarterback, is the easiest way to build a team and sustain success in the league. And the reason that I think that it's such a ritualistic thing on the media side of it is just because it's perfectly tailored for television. You know, the same way that I think at the NFL's success in the U.S., has been driven in large part by how good it is on TV. The rhythms of it are such that there's a play, you can talk about it. There's a play, you can talk about it. It's perfect to fill that space. The draft is the same way. There's 5 minutes per pick. So most of the time you're sitting there waiting, discussing, and anticipating. And I think that speaks to the larger idea in general of you can sell hope. You can sell teams getting better. The fact that the worst teams in the league are the ones drafting at the top, it makes it interesting for everyone. So even if your team was bad, if you're a Jaguars fan or a Jets fan, you're about to pick the quarterback who could save your franchise. So it automatically just creates interest across the entire spectrum of fan bases. And I think that's why people tune in every single year.
I think, and this moves slightly away from the business side of things, but it's an important thing to reference, because actually we talk about competitive balance on this podcast quite a lot, Ed. The fact that the draft always gives you hope ahead of a new season is quite an important thing. Certainly, I mean, I've mentioned your Chicago side of things. You also have a Crystal Palace side of things. You go into every season with Chicago, or even into a draft with Chicago, probably with more hope than you do with Crystal Palace.
Well, yeah, that's the kind of the huge disparity that we have, right, is that if you want Palace to go out and get someone realistically, you know that like there's only a certain pond that they can fish in, right? You know, Palace could spend what's the club record signing now? 30 mil on Benteke or Sacco. Like, that's as good as it gets. And you can't go and get one of the best players in the world, because that doesn't happen, especially not one of the best young players. If you are the worst team in the NFL, you can go and get a college superstar. You know, like Trevor Lawrence is going to be the number one overall pick this year. And if you've watched him at Clemson over the last couple of years, I mean, this is a guy who's done it in front of stadiums full of 100,000 people on, you know, huge primetime games in college football. And now he's just going to go to your team. And the turnaround from being the worst team in the league to suddenly having the best young quarterback, like Robert says, on a cheaper contract, changes everything. It completely changes everything. And even, you know, we're seeing the draft becoming so big now that you're getting year-round coverage of the draft, but you're also getting, on top of that, the idea that as soon as a team loses three or four games, their fan base just wants them to tank, and get the best player possible. So, you know, can you imagine that with Palace? No, because if you lose every game, you're going to get relegated.
We've spent a lot of time, actually, on this pod in the last 6 weeks, Robert, talking about salary caps in particular, players' unions winning court cases against the governing body of the Football League because they hadn't agreed to it and it wasn't fair, and so on and so forth. The players' unions all sign up to their salaries within the NFL, don't they? They have the collective bargaining agreement. But when it comes to the draft, Trevor Lawrence already knows what he'll be paid, does he, before he's even drafted by Jacksonville because of the system in place?
Yeah, and that rookie wage scale is based on the way that it was in previous years, and I also think it's tied to the salary cap in some extent. So if you look at it, for example, like Sam Darnold is having his fifth-year option introduced or exercised this year with Carolina. His fifth-year option as the third overall pick will only be about $18 million or so compared to what a guy like Mitchell Trubisky's would have been a year earlier, that would have been about $28 million, because the cap fell by about $15 million. So all of that stuff is agreed to. There are mechanisms in place according to the other money-making things throughout the league that define these slots and the draft picks that happened over the last 10 years. So there's no mystery whatsoever about how much these guys are going to get paid.
Does that help everybody involved, or are some people against that?
I definitely don't think it helps the players. I mean, if you were going to be drafted in the top 10, it's certainly better to have the old system where you can negotiate a deal. But it's all about a give and take. So in the old CBA, they wanted less practice time. There were other things in place that they wanted to win, and the rookie wage scale was a concession on their parts to give more money to veterans. So that's the give and take. Do you want the pool of money to be allocated to players already in the league, or do you want it to go to players coming into the league? The NFLPA decided that they would rather have a bigger slice of the pie go to a bigger selection of players, and that's how it ended up coming out. So if you look at it, I mean, it's kind of crazy just how drastic some of the seismic shifts have been from the previous CBA to this one. You think about the way practices look, how the money is allocated, all of that. It's only been 10 years, but it does feel like we've been living in this world for a very long time. It does feel like the status quo.
And it's massive that you know, the CBA, which we don't really have the same thing in the Premier League, but it's essentially the constitution of the league that's agreed between the players and the owners, right? They're the two sides of this bargain. And, you know, whether by accident or by design, what they agreed last time around has made the draft into even more of a spectacle, because the value of doing well is so much greater now.
But also, the people listening to this will go, well, hang on a minute, you've got both sides of the argument working together to make sure everything fits as best it possibly can for owners and players. And as you say, Ed, that collective bargaining, which is what it is, doesn't appear to happen this side of the pond.
The thing is here, we've got a very old system that we've just pieced together gradually over the case of, like, what, 150, 200 years, right? And it just got assembled by itself almost. The American sports leagues have done a much better job, I think, of commercializing themselves and working out a way. This isn't necessarily a commercial thing that the CBA, I know it's money involved, but really, this is just the agreement to get the players out on the field. And when they had, what year was the lockout, Robert, when they couldn't reach an agreement, so the players didn't play?
It was the summer of 2011.
You know, I can't imagine how on earth would that happen in the Premier League. You know, you can't get the clubs to agree on anything, let alone, you know, denying the players certain things. So it's a very complex set of agreements, but it really is key every time that they renegotiate this, which is roughly every 10 years. to just tweak it slightly to get the balance as close to perfect as you can. And, you know, like we say, listen to this podcast all the time, and you're talking about competitive parity and how important that is to creating a great product, to making it essential. And if I give you an example of a league where they haven't done this, but they've done actually quite badly, is La Liga. Mm-hmm. When they were the best league in the world in 2015, 2016, I was covering it quite closely. And the whole thing was, if they do not more fairly redistribute this money that they're making, then the league will suffer over the medium to long term, because you can't have such a wealth disparity between the top two clubs being the two of the richest clubs in the world and Leganés and Huesca at the bottom, who are essentially playing in front of like 3,000 or 4,000 fans and getting no money. And what happens is you see, you know, the league gradually deteriorates. Even the top two clubs now are in financial difficulties. And you compare that to the NFL, where, yeah, the Jags and the Jets have been terrible for virtually as long as I've been watching the NFL. And yet, you know, they're on a fairly similar financial footing to the rest. If anything, the Jags might be, you know, quite good going forward, because you've got the, you know, the London thing going on. If they get Trevor Lawrence and he is who we think he is for the next 10 years, that's a relevant franchise. And that's how quickly things can change. Whereas Leganés aren't going to be winning La Liga anytime soon.
Just a final thing on players and salaries, Robert, before we sort of move on to the draft and how it functions and the commercial importance of it. Over here in Europe at the moment, there's a striker who plays for Borussia Dortmund who is 20, called Erling Haaland, and there are rumours going around that his agent would like him to be the first £1 million a week footballer. So you're looking at £50 million a year, which has obviously provoked outrage, ridicule. How dare a footballer be worth that? If Trevor Lawrence, talk me through what Trevor Lawrence would expect to get for the first 2 or 3 years, and then if he's successful, what happens to his wages and his salary after that? As some kind of comparison to the bright, hottest thing in European football, which is Haaland.
Well, we just saw that happen. I mean, Patrick Mahomes is the best player in the world. He comes in. So the way that a first-round draft pick works, you can negotiate a new contract after your third season. So for Mahomes, it was actually only 2 seasons of starting because he sat out his first year. So after that, then his agent will go to his team and say, all right, do you guys want to renegotiate? They're incentivized to lock him in as soon as possible because traditionally the cap explodes. So if you know you want to re-sign a player, you should do it as soon as you can because that contract is going to look better and better over time. So they were incentivized to sign that extension after his third season. So they're going to sit down and they're going to say, all right, what are the parameters that we want to follow with this? Precedent is hugely important with these contracts. So they're going to look at some of the other deals that have been signed at that position for players at a similar standing throughout the league. With Mahomes, there almost is no precedent. He's so good and he's so young that they broke a lot of the mold. So what they ended up doing, what his agent ended up doing, was going in and saying, okay, we want the richest contract in the history of team sports in America. And they got it. I think it was 10 years, $450 million. No one had ever gotten that much. The NFL is obviously different because contracts aren't guaranteed. So he's not necessarily going to see every dollar of that, that he could get cut after a certain amount of time. Certain guarantees kick in at certain points in the deal. It's all very strange, and that's a huge reason that the contracts are so opaque in the NFL, but that's how it would work. So essentially what would happen next is, if Trevor Lawrence is what we think he is, his agent would go in after his third season. They'd look at the current quarterback contracts that have been signed. So that's going to be Dak Prescott's was the most recent, which was 4 years, I believe, $160 million. And they're going to say, we want $2 million a year more than what Dak Prescott got. The quarterbacks just re-up every couple of years, depending on who the next best one is.
Two things there. One, that you say that the NFL contracts are opaque, because compared to like European football, you at least know the amounts, right? The thing we don't know in NFL contracts are like the exact structure of a lot of this stuff. But we do know pretty much exactly how much these players are getting paid, whereas European football is very much a game of hearsay. Like, you have to depend on what, you know, the agent will tell you, because the club's definitely not going to tell you how much they're paying a player. And the other side of it is what you were kind of alluding to, is that I remember, you know, over the last few years, we've had a load of different names who were the highest paid quarterback in the league at any different stage. And 99% of the time, they're not the best quarterback in the league. Mm-hmm. It's just the latest guy to get a new contract, whether that's Matt Ryan or whether that's Tony Romo or like Derek Carr or someone. Like, these are guys who, it's just, they just take it in turns to become the highest paid player for like a couple of months, sometimes a couple of days, and then it moves on to the next guy. I don't know if that's going to change because of the COVID thing, you know, because that was the constantly ascending salary cap. And obviously that's changed a little bit, but it's just interesting how that happens, because in European football, I find that, I mean, apart from some outliers, the best paid players in the world are the best players in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose the NFL now has the best paid player in the world is also their best player in the game.
Yeah, that is true. But the Mahomes contract was a massive outlier, right? Because it was, I mean, it was unique. It was a unicorn contract.
And other agents will tell you that they shouldn't have signed it, that it's a terrible contract for Mahomes based on the structure of it, which is that's why it's interesting, because it's so long. The fact that it's 10 years, other agents with other quarterbacks will tell you they hate that contract. They hate that he signed it, because that precedent that they locked in is something they would never do for their own clients, because they want every 3 or 4 years to re-sign a new deal, because then you can grow as the salary cap grows.
Yeah, I see that. Like the Kirk Cousins thing, right? You know, if you're a more middling quarterback, then that definitely suits you. If you're Patrick Mahomes, securing essentially half a billion dollars at 22 or 23, whatever it is pretty sweet.
You know, I think I'd have signed that, Robert, to be honest with you. I think in that situation, even if my agent had gone, no, I'm not sure that's great, I'd have gone, no, it sounds all right to me.
That's always the question. And that's the interesting part with a quarterback, and Trevor Lawrence will be the next one in this conversation. Do you want to use every drop of leverage you have? And for the most part, the guys that want to be with their teams long term have not squeezed every drop of leverage out of these negotiations, because they want to maintain that relationship. And if you leave a little bit of money on the table, you can re-sign other guys. You know, Patrick Mahomes on the open market might be worth $50 million a year. But if he takes a little bit less, let's say it's $5 million less per year than he's worth, that's a $5 million player that the Chiefs can afford because there's a salary cap. So there's always a give and take with how these negotiations work.
And the final one on all of this, when a player signs a deal like Mahomes signed, is there then a discussion about how the Chiefs can earn the money back to pay that contract? And the reason I say that is because, again, going back to Haaland, £1 million a week for Haaland, the immediate, and Ed will know this, the immediate thing that everybody in European media discusses, well, how many shirts would you have to sell with Haaland's name on the back to afford that salary per week? So when Mahomes signs a $500 million 10-year deal, are there people within the US media and US football fans going, well, how do they earn that back? How do they commercialize that?
For the most part, no, because with the salary cap in place, you can only spend a certain amount of cash. Teams usually spend, the way that it works is strange. There's cash and there's salary cap. So teams typically spend about as much cash on player salaries as the cap is every single year. They try to go cap to cash. So in a typical year, it's about $200 million. For the most part, there was the same reason Ed said that the Jags and the Jets are on the same financial footing as a team like even the Cowboys, is that most of the team's revenue comes from collectively bargained television deals. So that's where, especially with player salaries, for the most part, that's already been negotiated every single time those new deals are signed. That's why huge increases in the salary cap are often tied to whenever those media rights deals are put into place. So that's where the team's operating capital, most teams, typically comes from in a given year.
And the new TV deal that was done recently, did that increase revenue for the NFL? Because again, there are huge discussions about when TV rights will be up in Europe next, that actually there will be a drop, that they can't continue. There was a little drop last time, but domestically, certainly in the UK, there's talk about quite a reduction for domestic rights. So who knows whether that will happen or not?
It did not happen that way. It was $100 billion deal. It's in right now, it's funny, and it's actually played into the way that teams have built this spring, because while the cap is depressed this year at $185 million instead of going up to about $210 million, teams are already planning that in 2023, it's going to be $230 million again. So they're already anticipating huge growths in the salary cap again because of how big these TV deals were. I mean, the debates and the negotiations for this were as ravenous and as aggressive as they've ever been for live television rights for football in the NFL. The sport is continually growing in a ridiculous way.
You know, when they talk about the cap going up in the NFL, it's basically a pop, you know, until the pandemic came along, it's just a thing every year. It's going up. So they're just paying bigger contracts with the expectation that there's going to be this constant growth. And I think in European football, there's a slight hesitancy that this is going to continue. And I wonder if this is going to be where we see the models kind of come into play, because there is no centralized thing in European football. And almost the best kind of best placed organization to take advantage of this is UEFA, is if you can negotiate bigger Champions League. And, you know, what they're trying to do, and we've talked about this ad nauseum on this podcast, right, with, you know, the Swiss model and all these things that they're trying to bring in the Champions League. UEFA are best positioned to keep the revenues going up more so than any other kind of individual domestic league. So I'm very interested to see how that goes down. And with that Mahomes deal in particular, we're going to see now, you know, when Messi and Ronaldo retire, I think in particular, we're going to see the first generation of like billionaire sportsmen, really. Kind of Michael Jordan obviously was the first, but we're going to have quite a few billionaire sportsmen coming along. Like the first thing Mahomes did when he got that big contract was he bought a stake in a Major League Baseball team. That isn't normal. That isn't a normal thing to go and be able to do, right? Yeah, we're going to have big professional footballers who can go and buy football clubs straight off the get. You know, as soon as they retire, they could go and buy into Miami, for example, like David Beckham did. The constantly rising cap in the NFL is actually going to breed like a very special generation of athletes who are absurdly wealthy, even though the argument still remains that the top quarterbacks are underpaid.
But and actually, you talk about the investment. Well, LeBron's investment arm, or who he works with, have just invested $700 million, I think it was, into Liverpool. So, I mean, again, it's slightly going off topic, but that's great, Robert. Are you seeing more wealthy American athletes investing in other businesses?
Absolutely. I mean, Alex Rodriguez is about to buy the Minnesota Timberwolves. I mean, it's kind of wild to watch that happen. And I think one of the other offshoots of this, as I alluded to, as these quarterbacks get wealthier and wealthier, is how is that going to impact player power in the NFL? Now that these guys are making so much money, you know, if you're a guy like Russell Wilson, for example, who is making $35 million a year and has been a highly paid quarterback for five or six seasons, you know, you've got $200 million in the bank or whatever it might be, and you don't want to play for the Seahawks anymore. There is no amount of money they could fine you that would prevent you from staying home. And I think that's going to impact this. Now, as quarterbacks especially consolidate power within the league, are they going to be willing to wield that power in the same way we've seen from NBA players and things like that? I think that's the really next question with how these finances impact player movement throughout the NFL.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
With the 75th pick in the 2012 NFL Draft, the Seattle Seahawks select Russell Wilson, quarterback, Wisconsin.
There you go. This is a kid I can't tell you how much I like.
On the TV deal, why is the sport deemed so important by NBC or CBS or Fox to pay even more for it? Where do they gain their value?
I mean, if you look at the most watched television events in any given year in the United States, most of them are live football games. I mean, even beyond the Super Bowl, you'd look at a typical playoff game. A regular season, like Sunday night football game in the NFL, gets more viewership than the World Series. So it's the popularity is overwhelming. I mean, it isn't the most watched live TV event in the entire country. And when you consider,
I guess more viewers than American Idol or America's Got Talent or whatever, Dan or the Masked Singer.
If you look at those lists, it's like eight of the top 10 every single year. Eight of the top 10 broadcasts every year will be NFL. And there might be like an NBA Finals Game 7 in there. And there might be like a State of the Union address occasionally from like non-sports stuff. But even, and you know, look at the most highly viewed American broadcasts ever. They're all Super Bowls except for, I think, the final episode of MASH.
Yes. Yes.
And that speaks to, there is no monolith culture anymore. There is no more MASH. And especially as we've come into a streaming world, everything is so fractured. I mean, you just look at the viewership numbers of everything, every TV show. It's a fraction of what it was 30 or 40 years ago because there are so many more options. But live sporting events, even if it's diminished a tiny bit, they've endured because it's one of the only things that is a piece of culture in the moment. You can't tape the Super Bowl and watch it the next day. That's just not going to happen. And that's why live sporting events are so attractive to advertisers, because it's really the only captive audience you're going to have at any point with the way that people consume media now.
In what is essentially, you know, a fragmented media world now, where people are getting their entertainment via such a huge amount of diverse streams compared to what they were doing before, it's literally the one thing you can rely on, live sports, to bring people in at the same time. And the NFL does it better than anyone else. It's not even close.
But Amazon have an NFL or a deal with the NFL, don't they? Amazon Prime have a deal with the NFL. But in the main, is it suiting the American market for the traditional broadcasters to have the sport and the streaming sites to focus on everything but the sport?
I think it's an interesting question. And if you look at what ESPN has done with some of their broadcasts, I think that they will tell you that they've gotten really good results from diversifying what those broadcasts look like. The College Football National Championship is a perfect example. So on ABC, you have the typical national championship broadcast. It's who Chris Fowler and Kirk Herbstreit and the team you would get every single time there's a big game on. But then on ESPN2, they have a different version where there are college coaches watching the game film from a different angle, explaining the plays to you. And then on ESPN Plus, they have kind of a younger generation of commentators talking about that as it's happening. And they plan to do that for playoff games. They did it last year when they had a wild card game for the first time. And as more and more platforms become available, and Amazon can obviously take advantage of this, they've already done it. I want to say Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks from the NFL Network had a separate scouts broadcast of games on Amazon even last year. So that's what's going to happen, I think. I think there's always going to be that broadcast that's geared toward your dad, but there are also going to be other options for a younger, more informed, more diverse fan base that wants to talk about and think about the game in a slightly different way.
Yeah, we've seen there's more like betting specific broadcasts. Even the Bears Saints playoff game last year was on CBS, but it was simulcast on Nickelodeon with like the kids in mind. Yeah. And it had the like splurge cannons and things like that whenever there was a touchdown. The other thing you've got to remember, Mark, is like the streaming services are obviously rising, but at the same time, ESPN has its own massive streaming service. CBS, which has NFL rights, has launched Paramount Plus, which is another huge streaming service on which you get a ton of football now. Champions League is on there. The Argentine football is on there. Brazilian football is on there. Europa League is on there. The Italian League, I think, is about to go on there as well. So like all of these TV channels, the traditional ones, NBC now has Peacock, which is trying to kind of force people through. So the Premier League, for example, I'm constantly like trying to find on which NBC app I need to find this Crystal Palace game because it's never clear, right? That's the one hard thing about watching sports in America is I never know what channel anything's on because they're constantly moving it around because they want you to download their streaming product, right? So I think there isn't as much differentiation anymore between streaming services and these TV channels because it's all part of the same deal now, quite frankly.
Did the Nickelodeon thing seem to be very well? I mean, everybody seemed to buy into that in the NFL community. I mean, I do think it is a fascinating opportunity when we look at what could be done with broadcasting in this country. Bearing in mind the constant debate about, you know, what audiences are broadcasters going for. Well, actually, with a bit of imagination and using your rights very cleverly, you can go for any audience you want. If you target them in different ways.
I mean, it's just so interesting that the NFL and Nickelodeon would decide that 3.5 hours of their airtime is better spent molding a football game to their audience rather than running reruns of Rugrats or whatever's on Nickelodeon at 3 p.m. on a Saturday. Like that really tells you how valuable of a product that it is, that a place like Nickelodeon would say, it is better for our bottom line to use this time to put an NFL game on our air.
But if I asked you, Mark, if the BBC took the FA Cup final and they had a simulcast broadcast on CBBC, which was aimed at the kids, but the FA Cup final. Now, I know that growing up, I would have loved that, right? And
yeah,
it's, even if it's just the first way in for some kids to watching a terrestrial game live, that could potentially be a huge thing for the FA, right? I mean, you can charge me for that at the FA.
No, it's an app. I mean, you know, I am not responsible for what my BBC managers decide to do. And I'm by no means giving them ideas. And again, if they do this, I'm charging them like you're charging them, Ed. But but if you have the different outlets that the BBC have for the FA Cup final, for example, and you put your traditional coverage on BBC One, but on the iPlayer do something like the coach's voice, but also have a feed for a teen audience and then put it on CBBC as well. Why not? It's the same game.
You know, as long as you've got a big audience coming in for something like this, and I think it would work for the World Cup, it would work for Euros. If you have a big audience, like giving, you know, segments of that audience exactly what they want is way more successful than trying to fit a product to everyone at the same time. I just, you know, like we've seen that with some of the stuff we've done. And I think that, oh, going forward, you know, when the event is big enough, these sporting leagues are going to be a bit smarter about what they do. And the Nickelodeon thing, I think, was the first example of that, that we're going to see in the next couple of years.
One of the things I often say to people when we talk about NFL, Robert, and obviously you will all know this, but it hits home if you talk to someone who doesn't really follow their American sport, is that there are more months of the year without NFL than there are with NFL, which in an era of where saturation appears to be key and more, and I know there's going to be another game coming next year, but more and more and more, I always think is a really interesting way that they do it. But that's because the draft is key to all of this, to bring it back to the draft for our final 10 minutes or so.
Absolutely. I think the draft is key, and the way that the league schedule is set up is key. You know, usually in a typical year, I know this because it aligns with my travel schedule. The Super Bowl ends, I go home for about 2 weeks, and then you get on a plane to go to Indianapolis for the combine. So instantly, 2 weeks after the Super Bowl ends, and you're kind of basking in the Super Bowl glow and talking about what the Buccaneers represent, and that's filling all of the time on ESPN's morning shows, you're into the combine right away. And that introduces you to that year's draft of players. Obviously, draft Knicks will have been watching them for months and college football fans, but if you're an NFL first fan, that's your first introduction, and it starts 2 weeks after the Super Bowl. Immediately after the combine is over, free agency starts.
So all the college players together, normally in normal circumstances, not at the moment, but all in Indianapolis, all being tested, how quickly they can run 40 meters, yep, how high they can jump, what they can bench press, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly, and that's all televised. Every 40-yard dash is on TV. So if you want to sit there and you want to watch them work out, which is still silly to me, but apparently it works for them, you can. And as soon as that event ends, free agency begins, and the fervor over free agency begins. By the time that free agency is over, as teams can sign veteran players, and that's where player movement happens, that's over about March 20th or so, then you have a month of lead up to the draft. So even if the NFL games aren't happening right now, still, from February through the end of April, the NFL owns the sports conversation because baseball is just getting started. The NBA playoffs haven't started yet. And then when baseball kicks into high gear and the NBA playoffs start, the NFL takes about 2 months off from its news cycle. And in July, training camp starts again. And then July through February, it's all football all the time.
I can't imagine how frustrating it must be to be a commissioner of one of the other major leagues. And just watching how like an NFL player sneezes and it becomes the top story on ESPN, you know, it does dominate the conversation. And incredibly, like you say, it does that pretty much year round. You know, the combine that Robert mentioned, I went for the first time. It was the last thing I did before everything shut down. And it's essentially an NFL convention. But like all of the coaches, all of the scouts, all of the star players about to come into the league, all of their agents and all of the media descend on Indianapolis, which I don't know if you've ever been, but it's essentially a convention center. You know, it's a city that is all inside, all underground. It's got about 3 steakhouses that everyone goes to. And you're walking around and it's like, oh, that guy's 6'9". He must be like a defensive end, you know? There's nothing like it in any other sport that I can think of. It literally is all of the important people from that sport descending on one place, and everyone just mills around chatting to each other. It's surreal.
But again, whilst there is obviously the sporting element, even something like the combine will have huge commercial opportunities for the NFL, I'm guessing.
Well, the sponsors are there in a huge way. That's you know, the obvious thing, right? And you know, I know that the Super Bowl, if you've, I mean, both of you will have seen that the amount of activations, et cetera, that you see around the Super Bowl, like Gatorade have got a thing, Old Spice have got a thing, you know, there's no brand which isn't represented there. The Combine is less commercial, but I understand that there's a lot of the big partnership discussions go down there because, you know, it's another opportunity for the NFL to bring people and walk them around and introduce them to Tom Brady and say, you know, like, this is what's going on.
How important then has the draft, particularly opening night, the first night, the first round of picks for the draft, how important has that become to advertisers and media outlets then, Robert?
I assume massively important. It's the reason that they've done it this way. I mean, they've only done the first round of the draft as its own night. I want to say for 4 or 5 years, it's still relatively early because it used to be, I think, the first and second round, and then the third through fifth round. Mm. And then this, I can't remember exactly. It's so funny how quickly it changes and how this seems like it's normal and the old version is outdated. Yeah. But the first round, this has not always been this way. And I think that they've realized they can turn it into this event. If it's 4 hours long and they turn into a primetime TV event, it's the same thing we talked about before. You know, in the NBA, if you look at the NBA draft and where players typically come from, if you don't have a pick in the top six, you are very unlikely to land a superstar player. Last year, you could argue that Justin Jefferson, who was the 22nd overall pick to the Vikings, the wide receiver, was the best rookie in the NFL last season. He was the 22nd pick. So you can drive this interest all the way from 1 to 32 because of the way football is structured. And I think they understand that. You know, they understand that they can have this four-hour event that people are going to be completely enraptured by in the same way, in a different way than it would be for any other sport.
But also, people turn up to watch it now, which obviously wasn't, you know, you watch old documentaries on ESPN. It was sort of 30 blokes in a room through cigar smoke and old-fashioned telephones and so on and so forth. You look at the one in Nashville a couple of years ago, which was the last sort of normal one, wasn't it, in inverted commas. It looked like they had a million people going down the street in Nashville. So, I mean, all of those commercial opportunities as well. I mean, it's just a money-making machine.
They've turned it into an event, which is so interesting to me. Seeing pictures of what's going on in Cleveland right now, the tent they have, it looks like the main tent at Coachella. The idea that they would turn the NFL draft into a festival of sorts, that to me is really interesting. And it's almost hard to believe that people would want to be there and be around it. But that's what the NFL is. It is such a monster that if you can be associated with it in any way, if you can reach out and touch it in some small way, people want to. I remember the draft was here in Chicago for multiple years. And it was downtown right in the loop. And in Grant Park, they had this massive setup and this installation that was kind of the fan experience. And people went. They'll sit there and look at the stage. It is really crazy how the league can attract that sort of interest in ways that don't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to want to go stand and watch someone announce someone's name from a stage, but people still want to do it.
But there are a few like administrative functions in sport basically that kind of rise above the others, and for me, like the World Cup group stage draw is one. Like it's an incredible moment. The Champions League draw is pretty good, but the draft, like, they've done something completely different with it, right? The group stage draw for the World Cup is mad because of what it means, but really it's just a load of executives in a room. Like, this is, you know, and if you think about the NFL, really, like, on top of being a you know, as notionally a sports league, it's a huge events business, it's a huge licensing and sponsorship business, and it's a huge media business. And all they've done is just convert one of their boring administrative functions into a huge event, a huge sponsorship event, a huge licensing and media event. And like, that takes some skill, and it takes some vision. But I guess the question is, what's stopping other people doing that?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know the answer. Is it just
no, I don't. That's why I just said yes. I think that's a great question. And I thought I'll leave Robert to try and answer it.
That's kind of my theory about the NBA, in that by the second round of the NBA draft, you're just not getting potential stars. There's no one for the most part that's going to come from the second round of an NBA draft and be an immediate impact player for your team. In the NFL draft, you can find a third round pick that can be a superstar for you. It's the peddling hope thing again. And with baseball, you're not going to see these guys for 3 or 4 years because of the way the minors work and just how large the baseball draft is. The NFL draft, I mean, I don't think people are sitting there watching the fourth and fifth round with the same sort of interest that they're watching the first and second and third rounds. I think that's why it's structured the way that it is. But I do think that because there are 22 starters, because of where talent in the league comes from, if you're a fan, you can talk yourself into the receiver you drafted 97th overall instantly walking in and changing the fortunes of your team. And I think that that's not how it works in other sports. It's just you can't sustain the interest because of where star players and where teams usually get molded.
And the incredible thing about, obviously, like every fan base, your team's drafted these players. And for the 5 months between the draft and the season starting, you can convince yourself that they're all going to be superstars, right? You know, the best thing about the run up to the new NFL season, you know, like you mentioned Palace versus the Bears earlier, Mark. What if Palace don't sign anyone in the summer, or they just, you know, they just sign someone on a free transfer? There's not that much to be excited about. Every year you have this infusion of talent, and every year there are going to be reasons, because at the end of the day, all of these college kids excelled at college. You're not kind of drafting the kids that couldn't get on the field for Alabama necessarily, because they wouldn't be drafted. There's too many college players in the pool. So all of these players have experienced success of differing degrees in their colleges. So you can always look at the highlights and say, yeah, he's good. You know, I think he's going to do it. And you know, the reality can be very different. But those months of hope are what changes it.
And what kill you. It's always the hope that kills you in the end. But of course, all of this and all of this success is based on the college system continuing in the way that it has done for many, many years, Robert. And there are, you know, huge critics of that system in that these college players are in an environment where, you know, there is millions and millions of dollars around in college sport. Coaches in college sport get paid millions and millions of dollars, and yet the athletes don't. And that will continue to be a huge debating point in the United States.
Absolutely. And I think that the number one issue right now that's at hand is being able to make money off your own likeness. I feel like we're very far away from college players receiving a salary just because of the way that college sports are structured. What do you do with a guy who's on the rowing team compared to Trevor Lawrence? That's difficult. But if Trevor Lawrence can go to anyone he wants and say, pay me, you know, a few million bucks to be in a Gatorade commercial, he probably should be able to do that. And I think that is going to be the next hurdle. And that's what's being heard at the Supreme Court right now, are these sorts of issues. So I think that to me is the next big question. Can these guys make money off of their names, even if they're not receiving any sort of salary from college football?
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people about this here, right? And the thing is, because everyone here grew up with this system, it's very just normal for them. It's when you have to explain this to a British person that's like, this doesn't make sense, right? It doesn't make sense that these kids don't get paid. And by the way, once they get drafted, they're drafted into a set contract, which they have no power to negotiate. And if this team decides that they want to keep them, the team can keep them for the first 7 years of their career, and there's nothing they can do about it. You know, like, that level of control is mad, and it doesn't really exist in almost any other sport, except, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, but baseball has some crazy rules, you know, around the service time manipulation and stuff like that, where you can keep sending players to the minor leagues and all that sort of stuff. But it's a mad level of control that these players have no grip on their own destiny until sometimes they're like in their mid to late 20s.
And even then, you're incentivized to take the deal, because if you can make that money right now, because NFL contracts aren't guaranteed, even if you were a first round pick, your fifth year option needs to be picked up after your third season, and they can just decline it. So if you want to have a contract extension as soon as possible, you're incentivized to sign it. That's why we have so many guys. Think about the best players in the league. Almost all, none of them ever hit free agency, because for the most part, their teams sign them to massive deals as soon as they possibly can. And because the cap grows in the way that it does, those deals become bargains for the teams very, very quickly. I mean, J.J. Watt was a perfect example. He's the best player in the NFL. He signs a contract extension. 2 years after he signs it, he's like the sixth highest paid defensive end. It is a system that absolutely does very well for the teams.
But also, if you look at Trevor Lawrence, and you know, his whole future, his next decade, probably turned on the fact that the New York Jets inexplicably won two games towards the end of last season, which meant they dropped from number one pick to number two pick. And when I say his whole life has changed, because, you know, I know people who've played NFL in New York. You play NFL in New York, you're going to have a very different life and probably commercial value to if you're playing 7 years in Jacksonville, aren't you?
Is that still the case, though?
I would say no.
Would you?
I would say no. Aaron Rodgers is one of the most famous people in American sports.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to Green Bay, Wisconsin?
No, I've not. No, but
I have many times.
Yeah. But the only thing that I would challenge you on there, Robert, and I am well aware of what Green Bay is like, but he is at one of the most storied franchises he could possibly be at.
I think that's true, but I think if you're a star in the NFL, the world is flat enough that it's going to be okay. And even right. Players that are taking free agent deals for the most part, I mean, you talk to some of these guys, especially the Packers are a perfect example. You know, they went on a spending spree 2 years ago. They signed Za'Darius Smith, Preston Smith, and Adrian Amos all in one offseason. And you ask those guys, you're like, why did you pick Green Bay? And they'll just say, they offered me the most money. It really is driven by that. And I think that because the league is so nationalized and because there isn't really any team can be good, and because of that parity, I think that if you're a good player, if you're a star quarterback, I mean, Kansas City isn't a big market, but Patrick Mahomes is the biggest star in the entire sport. And I just think that's the way that it's trending. If Trevor Lawrence becomes one of the best players in the league, his marketability will not be affected, I don't think, in any way because he plays in Jacksonville.
And again, before the digital era, right, the New York newspapers, for example, had an outsized importance in the national media scene. And his proximity to the New York Post, the New York Daily News, and the New York Times would have helped him, no doubt, right? And especially in terms of just being famous, just being able to get his messages out there and being able to get, like, you know, endorsements in a picture in the newspaper and make him more money. With social media and stuff these days, like, how many Instagram followers Trevor Lawrence has will not change almost certainly whether he's in New York or Jacksonville, apart from perhaps a slightly larger fan base of the team. But the way that the superstars are going these days, I just think he'll be huge wherever he is, if he's good.
Do these young men already arrive at the draft with a team around them? Obviously not a football team, but I mean, bearing in mind they're college students, but do they arrive at the draft with, obviously, agent, but social media and brand managers and all of that? Are they, if you're likely to go in the first 32, would you have that all in place?
Trevor Lawrence has everything you could possibly want. He has a marketing manager. I'm sure he has a team of agents. I promise you he has a commercial agent already. I mean, that stuff happened the moment that he signed. I don't know where he signed, but I mean, if you sign with Tom Condon, if you go to CAA and that's where you end up, I mean, they have a team of people. I mean, that team of people now takes care of you from the moment you put your name on that dotted line. That's why you go to a place like CAA or Athletes First or any of those. So, yeah, from the second he decided who his agent would be, that ball starts rolling.
And I believe it goes a lot deeper than the first round as well. You know, I think that, like, if you're expecting to be drafted, you're probably going to have an agent.
Mm-hmm.
And a final one then to finish on. This is, again, all the scouting and stuff ahead of this draft has had to be done slightly differently. No combine because of COVID. There have been various pro days, workout days, so on and so forth. Are all 32 teams preparing themselves for maybe a slightly riskier draft because they might go into it with slightly less knowledge?
I don't think so. The number one thing that a lack of combine takes away is medical testing. That's why the combine exists. It's for centralized medical testing, and that has somehow turned into a television event. But there was a centralized medical test in Indianapolis recently, even if all the players didn't go. So there might be a little bit more murkiness surrounding the health of some of these guys. But other than that, I think that there has been such a drastic shift in the way that teams accrue this information and the way they synthesize this information. You know, I was talking to a head coach last week, and he was talking to me about how one of his scouts told him that he watched a player run live at his pro day, and it made him think about the player in a different way. And the coach was like, why? Like, well, you're going to let these hours of game tape you watched get trumped by you watching this guy run in his underwear for 10 minutes? And I think that the leadership of the NFL has drifted in that direction. I mean, the Rams, we just wrote a great story about it at The Athletic. They didn't even send anyone to Pro Days because all of the data is centralized. It's all normalized. And they have tape of all of these workouts and all of these things. And I don't know if other teams will do that voluntarily anytime soon, but I do think that the league overall is kind of thinking back and sitting, are we doing this just because it's the way we've always done it? So I feel like there could be better decisions made with this year's draft and last year's draft than there was previously because a lot of layers of bias have been removed from the process.
And you ask if it's riskier, Mark. Remember, the draft's about selling hope. All it means is people are going to convince themselves that the fifth round pick they've got was underrated because this year was so affected by COVID, right?
Well, I hope you've enjoyed our delve into the draft from a business side, from a commercial side, and also the wider commercial issues with the NFL. I'm saying this to particularly maybe people who regularly listen to us who don't delve into the NFL. If you are a big NFL fan, or even if you're a sort of casual NFL fan, I have to point you in the direction of the Athletic's draft guide. It has ranked 636 prospects. There are 415 scouting reports. It is, Robert, a final word. It is a remarkable piece of work.
Dane Brugler does some of the best work of anyone in this industry, and how much he puts into this every single year is staggering. I don't know how you could get ready for the draft without it if you were a fan. I can't get ready for the draft without it, and this is something that I do for a living. I think that speaks to just its overall value.
If you are a fan, check that out, because it is a remarkable piece of work. And if you aren't a fan, then think 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, I was watching the draft and my wife watched half of it with me and said to me, I have no idea what's going on, but this is a lot of fun. So if you've never seen a draft before, I would point you in the direction from it because it is a lot of fun that opening night. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Ed. That's it. Don't forget, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll get all the analysis, the in-depth features, and ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman to take advantage of the special 40% discount. theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.
Brought to your ears by The Athletic, I'm Adam Hurry, and Football Clichés is the podcast you never knew you needed. Every week, to quite unnecessary depth, we examine the words, the phrases, the accepted wisdom, the mannerisms, the habits, the gestures, the symbols, the sounds, and the smells that everyone takes for granted in football, but which really are the glorious glue that holds it all together. For example, have you ever really listened to the Football League goals roundups? I mean, really listened to them? Because they all sound pretty much like this. Team X went into this game with just one win in their last 13, and when Team Y took the lead inside 4 minutes at Stadium Z, the home fans were probably starting to fear the worst. But Striker A had other ideas, and this game turned on its head in the space of 5 minutes midway through the second half. First, a smart finish from the edge of the box brought Team X level, and he repeated the trick on the hour mark to bring his tally for the season to 22. By now, Team X were in the mood, and although Striker A squandered a gilt-edged chance to complete his hat-trick, on-loan Dutchman winger B made it three with a curling effort from long range. Team Y's misery was compounded in stoppage time when midfielder C's late challenge on fullback D saw them reduced to 10 men. An afternoon to forget for manager E's men then, but Team X will hope they have finally turned a corner under caretaker boss manager F.
Listen to Football Clichés wherever you get your podcasts, and also ad-free when you subscribe to The Athletic.